What up, meepsters? This is Ryan Rainbro, and if you're hearing this, that means you're about to listen to one of the 99 free episodes of the Meep Meep Podcast, available wherever you cast pods. But keep in mind that there are new and unreleased episodes of the show on patreon.com/meepmeeppod. So you'll want to sign up there to hear future episodes and also other side projects like Choo Choo, the show about soundtracks, and contribute suggestions for future episodes as well. Will I listen to your suggestion? There's only one way to find out. patreon.com/meepmeeppod. Bye! What up, meepsters? I'm Ryan Rainbro, and this is Meep Meep, the podcast where we explore albums released on Roadrunner Records. And on this episode, we're celebrating and discussing the 25th anniversary of one of the greatest albums of all time. Not just released by Roadrunner, not just released by Fear Factory, but released in the history of sound, and that is Obsolete by Fear Factory, which came out on July 28th, 1998. And whatever day you're listening to this right now is at least 25 years after that. And we're talking to Burton Christopher Bell, known for short as Burton C. Bell. I don't know what the C stands for. And we're going to be talking to him all about making this album, some incredible trivia that you didn't know about certain songs on this record, the lead into it, the aftermath of it. And also we had a special cameo by Madchild of the hip-hop group Swollen Members that I used to listen to when I was a wee preteen. I would go up to Grandma's house, all right? She didn't have cable. She had two channels, one UPN, so I could watch SmackDown, which I believe came on Friday nights back then. It comes on Friday nights again. In between then, it came on Thursdays. Also, for whatever reason, even though she lived in the southeastern United States, I also was able to watch Much Music, a Canadian music channel, which had Swollen Members' Fuel Injected video playing on a loop, okay? With what other videos? Cardinal Official. Snow, the guy that did Informer, he had a new song at this time. It was called Joke Thing, and it was a joke thing to have to watch and listen to this cornball pretend he's Jamaican. But the point is, Madchild of Swollen Members participated in the creation of Obsolete by Fear Factory. Did you know that? Maybe you did. If you didn't before, you know it now. If you knew it before, you're going to know more now. We start our story off at the heels of Demanufacture, which of course there is an episode of the show on, with Fear Factory guitarist Dino Cazares and electronics slash producer slash mixer Reese Fulber, which you can check out now and you can check out later. But going into Obsolete, Fear Factory was kind of a new band. We had a new bass player, Christian Old Wolbers. And we had Reese Fulber fully integrated, not only into the band, but also in the producer role for Obsolete.
We started working with Reese with keyboards, essentially. And then he became more of an integral part of the mixing process and getting the sounds and just like moving towards the sound that we were looking for. He never wanted to be a full member. He was like the silent fifth member. His loyalties were to Frontline Assembly, also to Delirium. And we respected that. He actually played live with us a couple times at a festival or two. And one was the Dynamo. That was fun. But Reese was definitely integral part of the band at that point. He produced the Obsolete record with Greg Reilly mixing. And Greg Reilly was also co-producing as well. So it was a great time, man.
And so with, you know, the records beforehand, Colin Richardson was the producer. Now you have Reese, who essentially was like the mixer on the manufacturer. And I know he added the electronic parts as well, but he's full on production role. But like you said, he's like kind of in the band too, even though he's not in the band. So
right.
What was that dynamic like working with somebody who's more, I want to say more your friend than like your, not your boss, but I don't know. I see a producer as like this, like adult that comes in the room and is like, no, we need to do things this way. Whereas this is like a, someone.
It was more of like, he was a sounding board a lot. He was, you know, he would offer a different, inspiration or a different, perspective about whatever we were doing. The growth from Soul New Machine to Demanufactured Obsolete is exactly that. It was a growth of the band, of what we were doing through experimentation, through trying to achieve the best sounds possible. The Soul New Machine, for instance, I call that the primordial state of Fear Factory. And it was where we were just like, okay, three guys getting together and we're just trying to create music and we're just throwing all different elements into the mix and just seeing what we could make stick and just what we're writing really. And then it wasn't until Demanufacture and that we had under our belt a few tours, right? So at that point we were touring with a lot of hardcore and some death metal, hardcore death metal bands, doing a lot of festivals. But the touring with the hardcore bands was really inspirational for me personally. In particular, opening up for Biohazard and Sick of It All. Luke Holler is an amazing frontman. Incredible vocalist, but an incredible frontman to begin with. And watching Luke Holler of Sick of It All was very inspirational. And you know, I'm watching hardcore bands play and interact with their audiences was also like a learning a lot. So we're not just me, just everyone else in the band was learning how to be not just in a band, but a performing band, a performance band, and writing songs that we can play live, but are moving forward. And it was just a lot of experimentation going on. It was really awesome. So, and then, you know, the Obsolete, obviously we have more tours. Demanufactured made quite a mark when it came out. And so we had a lot to prove, honestly. And Roadrunner was very positive and very, just very positive about our future. And so they were putting a lot towards it and they're putting a lot into the development of Fear Factory at that point. And so they had, they put all their efforts at that point into it. It was really amazing. We had a lot of potential while we were writing Demanufacture, recording Demanufacture. We actually met with Jimmy Iovine at Interscope Records. There was a A&R guy, Ray Santa Maria, who he befriended us because he loved us. And he wanted to sign us to Interscope prior to Demanufacture. And Roadrunner just held us tight and didn't let us go. Yeah, so it was one of those things that there was a lot of hope and a lot of push towards this band to make us, excel us even further. So it was a lot going on.
Do you think, going back to you talking about touring with these hardcore bands and kind of seeing them and their more performance and energy-based demonstrations, do you think that helped move Obsolete also even more towards a, you know, it's still got the industrial feel to it, but it has like more organic instruments and sounds to it?
Absolutely. What we did with Demanufacture, it's a very precise sounding album. It was really good. Still had hardcore elements to it. Still had just really like aggressive sound, but it was a very sound of it was just a very aggressive and just very cold and calculated, really. And we wanted to warm it up. And with Christian coming into the band, Christian came in while we were still touring on Soul New Machine. So he came in for the tour that we did with opening up for Sepultura on Chaos AD tour. And it was Fear Factory, Clutch, Fudge Tunnel, and Sepultura. That tour was also unbelievably, incredibly fun and badass. And, you know, watching Clutch every day and Fudge Tunnel. I was already a fan of Fudge Tunnel and I was already a fan of Clutch. At that point, Sepultura was just on fire. Incredible record to watch them tour on. We are learning a lot. We had two songs done for D-Manufacture at that point. So we had Piss Christ written and we had another one called D-Manufacture. We had D-Manufacture written. We were playing those live as a, you know, as a little sneak peek on, in our set. And they were very raw at that point, no keyboards, whatever. But it was a lot of fun. So Christian started finding his footing during that time, finding his place in the album and the band. And so when Obsolete finally came around, he had written parts. He had an idea and a concept of what he wanted the bass to sound like. And so it was that really made help Obsolete sound very deep and organic, and which D-Manufacture had bass, but it was a lot of it was following the guitar, whereas Christian was, you know, being a bass player. That was the first time we've actually had a bass player.
We'll be back after a quick break.
If you love good music and good podcasts, you'll love Roots Music Rambler. I'm Jason Falls. My co-host Francesca Folinazzo and I talk to the singers, songwriters, musicians, and more in Americana, alt-country, bluegrass, folk, blues, and beyond. We share our own takes on the latest news in the space and recommend new music for you to explore every episode. Come get to the roots of the music you love. Find us at RootsMusicRambler.com or go wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to Roots Music Rambler.
Yeah, you can definitely tell that the bass is a significant ingredient to Obsolete, whereas it has different tones. I mean, you know, of course, there's the obvious of the upright bass on Edge Crusher, or there's that deep distorted bass on Descent that, you know, yeah, really stands out. So those are two moments just right off the top of my head that that the bass is a factor, whereas before, like you said, you didn't really think about it. It's just kind of following along with the guitar. You think of the riffs, you think of the precise drumming, the vocals. Now right. You have an extra element that people can kind of identify with.
Right. Exactly. And it was, Christian actually was studying bass. He found we recorded in Vancouver and he befriended a person who worked at a music store in Vancouver who was a bass player. So he got a lot of, almost like a tutorial on the bass. And that's when he actually got his first Fender Jazzmaster. And that's the bass mostly used on the record, where before it wasn't really more of an afterthought, but it was, he really studied and really put all of his efforts into being a bass player. And stand-up bass was really fun. That was incredible. The purest non-conformist. Not so cool on tour because it took up half the space in the truck or the bins or whatever. It was like a gigantic flight case.
Wait, you would take the upright bass on tour to just play the one song?
Yes, we did.
Okay, very cool.
Not really, but it was cool. But for one song, it was a lot.
Yeah, I don't remember that. I definitely saw, what was it, Static X, Dope, Fear Factory? And I believe you, but I don't remember the upright bass coming out.
No, it wasn't on all the tours. There's just one tour, I think.
Okay. Well, you know, of course, Obsolete's got this like concept aspect to it. And you being the writer of both the lyrics and just kind of the a writer in general, you got the...
Well, thank you.
What came first? Did you have this story written out and you were like, oh, this would be awesome if we made an album out of these different parts of the story, or you had the songs and
that story? It all came organically, honestly. So I didn't have the story at first. So we wrote, I was writing lyrics and I was just coming up with concepts of each song and, you know, writing lyrics of, you know, what I do, just, you know, taking what I see in the world at the time and just moving it forward, projecting it into another time and just as sci-fi writers do. They write about what they see, but they project. And it wasn't until the album was completely recorded and we had a song listing of the how of the arrangement of how it's going to be appear on the album. So I create with that song listing, I created an outline. And with that outline, I created a story of, okay, this is what's happening in this record. And this is a storyline. I did the same thing for D-Manufacture actually, but it was more of a synopsis. Roadrunner asked me at the time when D-Manufacture was coming out to, you know, oh, we need descriptions of, you know, explain what each song means. Instead of explaining what each song meant, I just wrote a little paragraph, kind of like a little story for each one of like, this is the story of this, this, this. And that went out to press, but no one ever talked about it, which was strange. But it was, I wanted to do it right on Obsolete. So I used it as an outline and wrote the story, and it just everything worked out. To me, I wrote it on, took me a couple weeks, maybe 2 or 3 weeks to write it completely, because I was just using the lyrics as part of the storyline and just interjecting storyline into it to propel it further, just to finish the story. And I wrote it on a Smith Corona typewriter.
Oh, wow. You typed it out old school. You're like a real writer.
Yeah, I typed it out old school. That was before I had a computer. That was, what, 98. So I didn't get my first computer until 2000, which was Digimortal. But that's how I wrote it. So I still have those papers.
Oh, that's incredible.
I have saved everything I have ever written. I have an incredible collection.
I find that even more impressive. I'm not sure why, but I do, that you wrote the story afterwards, because the music would have already existed. So you're kind of, I don't want to say shoehorning, but you're finding ways to fit that into the music. And I think that would be more difficult than writing it out first and then the band being like, okay, we're going to write music that fits that mood.
Actually, shoehorn is an interesting concept, but it's for me, it just seemed to work. You know, once I came up with the concept of what this whole thing was about, once using the outline, it took, you know, I didn't think of it overnight. It took a little bit of time, but once I figured out the concept, just everything clicked and it just came, it just like poured out of me and literally just like flowed. And the inspiration I was feeling just was so driving. It just felt so great. I just couldn't stop writing. I would stay up all night long just writing. And I go back to it in the day and it's like, okay, here's it here. And just begin again. It's like, here we are. And just I kept going and going. And I was editing it myself and learning how to do that. And just, it was an incredibly, really great learning experience for me and a great time.
So there's got to be an extended version of the story that exists then. If you're writing and writing for weeks, I mean, it's got to be more than just like these 10 or so paragraphs that make it.
There's a lot that got edited out for sure. Because I had to fit it into a 12-page, 15-page booklet, something like that.
Have you ever thought of trying to make that into a graphic novel like you did with The Industrialist years later?
Well, to me, it already is one. It reads like a script. It has visuals by Dave McKeon. It's not your typical graphic novel, but to me, that's exactly what it is. And so why fuck with it?
No, that makes sense. Well, going to the cover then, you know, you got Dave McKeon, who did, of course, D-Manufacture also. Did you collaborate with him on what the idea of the album was? And he kind of generated that crazy
Absolutely.
Cover?
Absolutely. I developed a working relationship with Dave McKeon during D-Manufacture. And going back and forth, before emails, we were faxing ideas on the phone. I'm very fortunate. I have the ability to describe exactly what I see or want to picture in my head. So I could, when it comes to artists, I can elaborate very well what I need to, what I'm picturing or what I can picture. And that way it gives the artist so much a material to work with that he just throwing stuff at us all the time. And I was like, no. And we still have it. I got the facts of this idea that he sketched out, which later became the actual album cover, Demanufactured. And I was like, fuck, that's it. That's perfect. And I did the same thing working with for him with an Obsolete, scribing, you know, telling him what the lyrics, I would send him the lyrics. And he would just basically just absorb everything I sent him, and communication, more faxing, more phone calls. And it took some time, but once he came up with that concept, I was like, holy shit, that's pretty incredible. So yeah, working with Dave McKean was fun. We worked with him. We were working with him on Digimortal, but that's a long story. It never worked out. Inter-band tension.
I gotcha. Okay. I love that this futuristic album involves typewriters and fax machines.
Well, you know, you got to use what you could use. And at that point, faxing was futuristic. You know, it was over sending electronic data over landlines. And that was the future at the point.
Do you remember what song, you know, you're talking about how with Demanufacture, you guys had already had Piss Christ and Demanufacture and you're playing those live. Do you remember what musically you came up with for this batch of songs for Obsolete?
We didn't start writing Obsolete until we were done touring with Demanufacture. And it took us, usually every record came out 3 years afterwards. So it kind of took us, a year to write and record this album. We toured Demanufacture almost from 92 to 94. And yeah, we didn't start recording Demanufacture in 94. So Demanufacture came out in 95, toured 95 and 96. And we started recording Obsolete in the beginning of 98. Like right January 98, we all flew up to Vancouver. I guess we were writing a few months before we went up there. And we're still kind of writing when we got into Vancouver, honestly. I didn't have all my lyrics done. Some ideas weren't concrete. My ideas, at least. For instance, the song Resurrection. I had a basic idea, but I wasn't feeling it. Reese wasn't feeling it. So while I'm recording vocals for Resurrection, we're like, I'm not feeling it. Let's take a break. And me, Reese, and Dino were sitting in the studio, the main room of Mushroom, actually. We were at Mushroom Studios and we went to the Armory. And so at Mushroom, I'm sitting at a piano just trying to like come up with like a melody of some sort. And it was while we were brainstorming, it finally came to me. It was like, snapped. It's like, I got the fucking idea. Let's go in there. And as I was developing the idea, you know, going through the vocals and developing the idea, Reese said, okay, I hear it now. So I just kept going through it. And Resurrection became one of my favorite songs on the record, honestly. I didn't have lyrics for Edge Crusher. Edge Crusher was, we had the title. I came up with the title by looking at a box, a cardboard box in our studio. And the cardboard box on the corner said Edge Crush 20 pounds. So I was like, huh, that's a good title, Edge Crusher. I'm like, okay. So I had a title. I had some ideas, but not a lot. But having Christian while we were in Vancouver, he befriended a band, a hip hop group called Swollen Members. And he had invited Mad Child down to the studio to basically help me out. And we kind of brainstormed, came up with lyrics together.
We'll be back after a quick break.
But you still loading them and heating them up with all your single shit you've been dropping. You feel me? Loading them up on. It only takes structure. And you know, just paying attention to the climate of the game.
Yeah.
Know what I mean?
So do
Do your homies got a role in your little, you mean?
Yeah, we all artists over here, man. I'm trying to get them on there. We all artists, man. We gonna have this like.
Bro, me and my man Kyle, we be like, I don't know, we play with this shit right now. I gotta lie, we play with this shit right now for real.
Don't play with it. Take that shit serious.
That's right. Madchild, a Victoria, British Columbia hip-hop group's swollen members at the time, helped Burton write and record the song Edge Crusher, which ended up being one of Fear Factory's biggest songs, one they never stopped playing from the time it was released to present day. And so I was able to catch up with Madchild to discuss that, collaboration, meeting the band, kind of how it all came together.
Yeah, so basically we met the group through Christian. So I was in a group called Swollen Members back then from Canada, Vancouver, BC. And we went on to do very well as a sort of underground hip hop group that became sort of mainstream or whatever, I guess you'd call it in Canada. And we had good sort of underground success worldwide. We had a good run as well. So we actually met Christian in the beginning of Swollen Members, who was into hip hop, and he actually went by the name of Edge Crusher and played bass on a few of our first singles of our first 12 inches that we put out through Fat Beat. So that's how the friendship started with the group through Christian. And then they invited me. Of course, I went and checked out one of their shows when they played at, it might have been Ozfest or something like that. I can't remember. It was some big festival where I met the guys and we went out and hung out a couple of times. Everybody got along great. This is when the group was Bert, Christian, Dino, and Raymond. So, great group of guys, bunch of characters, had a good time. And they invited me to the studio when they were recording that song, which I believe was the Armory back then in Vancouver. So there was like two main studios, the Warehouse, which is Brian Adams' studio, and then the Armory is the other like big sort of big A type of studio. So I went out and hung out there, and they were working on the song, and they had a 8-bar section for a rap thing, and I just quickly wrote something up and then sort of laid down scratch vocals of how to say it, because obviously with rap, you know, it's not, if you're not a rapper, well, even if you are a rapper, somebody could write lyrics, but how you're going to say them is a completely different thing than just reading the words on paper. So I did sort of a little rough thing. It's just as far as how the timing of the words were supposed to go. And then Bert came in and crushed it and did it in his style, and it worked out great. So I was honored to be a part of that project. And the guys were cool enough to give me a gold record when it went gold. And yeah, it was dope.
Oh, that's sick. Yeah, I didn't even think about that you would have gotten the accreditation. Was there ever like consideration for you to just do the rap, like for you to be on the song?
No, we didn't. I don't think it would have made sense, to be honest with you. I think, from a listening point of view, it made more sense for Bert to do it. But I can't remember if it was discussed or not. But I think it all worked out how it was supposed to work out. Bad decision. Fatal error, get scars from bars of barbaric terror. We
own label, never get dropped. Now the crew combined and we can't be stopped. He was almost acting like a tutor for me. It's like how he approached his vocal style, how he approached his style of spitting word, and he helped me move and create my own kind of version of it. So it was very cool. The other member,
you're talking about Zodak, the producer / DJ.
He did the scratching on Edge Crusher. So the wait there. So he came in, did the scratching for that. He used a Van Halen record, actually.
That's crazy. Do you know about Van Halen record?
Van Halen 1.
Wow. And who's doing that spoken intro right before the song starts?
Due to the graphic nature of this program, listener discretion is advised.
So that's an old friend of ours that we knew for a long time named Pat Howard, who's also, he was Phantasma in Brujeria. But he was Adam Baum. His name was Pat Howard, also named as Adam Baum. He's in a lot of, he was a DJ at KXLU for a while in LA. He was also in a band with Dave Smalley, hardcore band.
Yeah, I think he's like involved or was involved in like Lucha Libre wrestling in Mexico, right?
Yes, absolutely. He's a big wrestling fan. And he had the perfect voice for like voiceovers, like Pat, come and do this. And he just one take, done.
Oh, that's awesome. Do you remember what were some of the earlier musical songs that you guys had written, though, that where you knew like, okay, this is like going to be the vibe of the record? Was Edge Crusher one of them?
It was one of them, but Shock was one of the first songs we wrote. Obviously, because we spent more time on it because it was the first one. And that's why it became the first album song on the album. Timelessness was an idea, really, more than it was a song. We knew what we wanted to do. So that was more developed in the studio in Vancouver than anywhere else. It was an idea more than it was a song. And that developed into something really cool, too. Smash or Devour was another song that was almost fully developed. And I got that title from an anime film that I was watching. And it was some character in the anime film. I was like, wow, that's a cool. And it was the translation.
You can't assume that beings more powerful than man are necessarily wiser.
Because it was, it was on the translated words across the screen. It was like, Smash it out. I was like, holy fuck.
And do you ever feel like it's borderline irresponsible to have the sickest 1-2 punch opening of an album with Shock and Edge Crusher? Do you feel like it's just like discouraging the other bands to even attempt to have two songs as sick as that to open up a record?
No. we had a lot to prove going from demanufactured to obsolete. People were, thought we were like a one hit wonder or a one trick pony. It's like, nope. There's more. Just hold my beer. So I think, you got to come out strong. And that's what Roadrunner wanted, because they were putting a lot of assets and a lot of time behind promoting Fear Factory. And they did so. They even flew out Gary Newman for the Cars cover. When they got wind that we were covering, that we were going to do Cars, because we were doing Cars in Europe during the demanufactured tour. It's just like a funny thing, because at that point in Europe, I think Heineken was using it for a song and a commercial. And so we just started fucking around. We started playing just part of the song live. It's just like a fucking around thing. And by the time it came to record, it's like, hey, let's just record it, see how it turns out. And when Roadrunner got wind of that, they're like, hey, well, if you guys want to do this right, let's get Gary Newman. And they flew Gary Newman out to Vancouver. And of course, in Gary's awesomeness and professional ability, he goes in and whips it out in one take. Watching him do that was just insane.
So Roadrunner's who reached out to Gary Newman. It was their idea to like have the original artist on the cover. They just knew you were going to do it as like a B-side or something like that.
Yeah, they got wind that we were going to do it. And so they made that happen.
And then while he was there, you were just like, hey, while you're here, you might as well record this intro to the title track.
Yeah, he's like, fuck it. So I had these words written down. He perfectly did it. I was like, holy shit, cool.
Nothing Mr. White says is any man of a mission. Dominate this Christ. What in man will earth be? Ancient British to eradicate humanity.
It's weird that that song was like my least favorite song on the record.
The song Gary Obsolete?
Newman's, yeah, Gary Newman's part is the best part of that song for me. It's just a basic song for me. It's basic. It's like a hardcore song. And it was, you know, that usually they thought the title track would get top billing, but that, it didn't because it wasn't one of the stronger songs on the record to me, in my opinion.
Yeah, I feel like you're talking poorly about one of my best friends when you're saying these words.
Hey, man, I like the song. It's just not one of my favorites.
Well, that song has a style that also Edge Crusher has and Shock has that is a lot more prevalent on this record than it was on previous records, and that is that, like, single note riffing, you know, the obsolete, like, da-na-na-na-na-na, obsolete.
A lot like Scapegoat.
True. Yeah, no, it wasn't like it didn't exist at all before, for sure. But I felt like this record really leaned into it as far as the guitar riffing. And, you know, that's kind of like the style at the time of what we now, in retrospect, but did not at that time call nu metal, you know, where the kind of single note stuff.
I think what one song that really highlights that style is Freedom or Fire. I love that song. That's one of my favorite songs on the record, too.
Yeah, what I love about Freedom or Fire is that the drums are almost the riff in that. You know, the riff kind of follows the drums, but that has that drum intro that it feels like is like the foundation of the song.
Well, that's how most, pretty much 90% of the songs are written.
Okay.
By following the drums.
Going back to Cars, though, so you're recording Cars. Obviously, it becomes the big hit. The record goes gold. It's a song that Fear Factory ends up being known for a lot of people. That time, when I know you're recording it as like a B-side, you guys are like, hey, we're having fun. Heineken's using the commercial. We have this fondness of it because of that. But when Roadrunner's like, oh, well, we're going to release it as a single. We're going to get Gary Newman. Do you have any apprehension at the time of the perception of the band by the public, especially with how the 80s covers are kind of like a thing in that time?
Well, Roadrunner wasn't going to use it as a single at all. First release of Obsolete, Cars was not on it. And it wasn't until it was a radio station in New York City that picked it up, started playing it. And with that popularity growing, Roadrunner was like, fuck, we got to re-release this album as a digipack and put Cars on it as like a main like B-side single kind of thing. So it was an afterthought. You know, they just thought it was going to be cool to have Gary Newman on the song. To me, it seemed like an afterthought. It blew up. And that's, you know, that song, because of that song, we got a gold record and we got a lot of press and we got a lot of publicity, and it really propelled us into a whole nother realm of, you know, being a band. Is crazy.
But so you're saying you only were happy about the benefits of it. You had no worries or apprehension about like, oh, we're going to be another band that covers the 80s.
Yeah, there was a little bit of apprehension because we had the first video from Obsolete was Resurrection. And, you know, we made a video for it and it was doing all right, but it wasn't until Cars just like got picked up. And, you know, obviously doing a cover song, and it was weird, but at the same time, I was like, you know what, fuck it. You know, we made a great version of it. And matter of fact, Gary Newman, now still these days when he plays it, he doesn't play our version, but he plays a heavier version of it too, because it's, you know, he's moving with the times. It's just to make it more exciting. But no, I think it was what had to be done, and that's what it is. So if I had apprehensions, they were definitely dissolved quickly.
That gold record probably washed away any doubt or worry.
And, you know, we would play it one from time to time at a, but not a lot, but whenever we played it, people loved it.
Well, you mentioned the resurrection video, you know, that video is kind of used as like a way to condense the story of the album into a few minutes. And you're also telling me that you're pretty good at like articulating what your vision is for things. Do you feel like that video kind of held up to at that time what you wanted the visual representation to be?
Yeah. Again, the director's name was actually Bill Ward, not Black Sabbath, but another Bill Ward. I think that was his name. But he later became a guitar player for Skinny Puppy.
Oh wow, full circle.
But he listened to the song and he came up with this great concept, and I was like, yeah, looks good. And we were on tour with Slayer, and we went to Toronto to do the video, and as quickly as we could, and did a pretty good job. Like Bill Ward did Replica. William, I think it was William Morris. He did a great job, and I loved the concept, and he had a great plan, so we just went with it. He also did Cars, and the kid in the Cars video was later in a movie called The Ring.
The scariest movie I've ever seen in my life, when that girl comes out of the TV.
I think it was The Ring. He was in a horror film, but it was pretty cool. And Gary Newman said one of the funniest things ever while we're doing the video in our spacesuits suspended in front of a green screen. He's like, odd, songs about cars. What are we doing in space?
He said, odd. Oh, odd.
You know, in his very English manner.
Now, your collaborator in Ascension of the Watchers works with Gary Newman too, right? So are you, does that?
He had worked with Gary Newman, but I didn't meet him through Gary Newman.
Oh, okay.
I actually met Jace through MySpace.
Another futuristic reference.
Hey, it was before Facebook.
That's right. He was in your top eight, Jace?
Yeah, it was we communicated, and I had no idea how MySpace worked, but he would message me or whatever he would do, and we talked to each other that way. And then I finally met him on tour like several years later in the UK. He's like, hey, I live near there. Can I come and show? So I put him on the guest list, and that's where our friendship began.
Oh, that's awesome. That's a beautiful story.
I got a lot of them.
Okay. Well, can you please tell me the story of why Descent wasn't immediately the idea for the first single for this record?
That is a very good question. It should have been the first single. To me, that would have been the one to go with. But I think Roadrunner felt that it wasn't banging enough.
Okay.
So, I mean, we all made our choice of Resurrection and the edited version of it. It's like, okay. Descent was cool. That was a cool song. That was one of the first ones we were writing too. And I remember I was getting inspiration from the oddest places for the chorus. I was listening to a Bone Thugs and Harmony album. And there was this one part, and I was like, well, that's a cool, it wasn't the lyric, it was like a cool melody he used just briefly. I was like, oh, that's cool. So I just started, like, I tried to emulate it and came out with Descent. It was interesting. It's the first of the month. It's time to get up. Descent. How deep I descend till I reach my end.
That is a life-changing piece of trivia. Yeah, I think, you know, Descent, immediately when you hear it, it sounds like the hit, right? And I got to imagine that when you guys are coming up with that song, that everyone is psyched about it, because like you referred to earlier on, you didn't want all the songs to sound the same. And that one definitely has its own vibe to it that doesn't sound out of place, which is cool, but also sounds totally different because it's mostly the singing, I guess, would be. And it has that melody.
Right. Right. And it's a great song. It's got a great chorus. It's got a great hook, and it's got great music's awesome. The production's awesome. It would have been a great single, but it would have made a great video too. It's one song I do plan to play when I get back out on tour.
Yeah, that and Resurrection both have those really melodic choruses that I think would sound great and not out of place with what you do now too. Both Resurrection and Timelessness have that like symphony orchestra sound on the songs. Is it an actual orchestra that came into play, or is it just samples?
It was a chamber group that Reese hired. He sent the music to arranger, the conductor, and he wrote the arrangements, and he wrote it all out musically. The tablature, he wrote
the
out
theory?
The tablature. No, he wrote out the tablature for the strings, and it was all strings pretty much. But it was like a chamber group, and they came in, and it was live strings. And I had this vocal melody that I had sung to Reese, and he transcribed that into like a keyboard line, and that's how they use that. So I recorded to live strings, honestly. That's how I did it. So uh-huh. They did that, and I recorded to live strings. And we did that at the Armory. I did it in the main room, and because the main room is like a big, looks like inside of a church. And lowered the lights, had candles, and just me by myself. And it was a moment. It was a real moment.
Oh yeah, you built a whole vibe. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's what music is. It's a vibe. You got to create a vibe, and you have to have a vibe to really help tell your story. And that's what that's about.
And with Timelessness, famously, supposedly, you reached out to Sarah McLachlan to...
I didn't. Reese did. Oh, yeah. I called her up. She's in my Rolodex.
I thought maybe you sent her a MySpace message. I didn't know.
No, I had a I didn't even have... That was before MySpace. That was...
I know. I'm just...
I still carry my Rolodex around. And you must be the age where you don't know what a Rolodex is.
I know what a Rolodex is. I have one. You had to turn it. I had my little 3x5 cards.
I would carry that on tour with me.
Wow. Well, I don't know if I ever made mine mobile, but I definitely had them because I would reach out to my relatives on my birthday and make sure they knew to send me some cash.
That's a great band name. Mobile Rolodex.
All right.
I'm writing it down. I got a whole list of band names, and that's a new one.
Reese reaches out to Sarah McLachlan. Were you aware? I mean, I assume you were aware of who she was at the time. She had the
Oh, yeah.
Building a mystery song and stuff like that. Did you think that was a good fit? Was there a idea you had for a collaboration on that song? Like, did you hear a female vocal on it or anything like that?
I did it. I honestly, Reese, like, we could get Sarah McLachlan to do backup. And it's like, oh, yeah, if you can get her, I mean, sure, why not? But obviously, it never transpired. But I don't know. It would have been cool, I guess. I never had like a duet on a Fear Factory record until Digimortal.
And what a duet that is!
Be real. That's awesome. But I totally forgot about Sarah. We reached out to Sarah McLachlan. I think she was just not available, honestly, at the point.
Do you think Reese deliberately sabotaged it since he immediately had that Delirium song come out right after Obsolete?
No, but he definitely kept in contact with her.
So around this time, you know, this is 98, 99, you are guest vocal superstar, all right? You're on the Soulfly record. You're on the Spine Shank record. You're on the Kilgore record.
Oh, yeah. I was doing a lot of that.
Spine Shank and Kilgore, you guys are touring with them around the same time, too. So is that how those came to be? You were playing shows and they were like, oh, it'd be cool if you were on?
We were friends with Spine Shank already because they were local. They were an LA band and they got signed to Roadrunner. And you know, Johnny Santos said, "Hey, you want to come in?" I'm like, "Sure." Kilgore, we were touring. We had toured with them with Slayer, and we befriended Jay and Michael and Marty, who's now with Lita Ford. They just kept in contact with me, and when they were recording in LA, and asked if I could come down. It's like, hell yeah. So that was that TK421, which is a Star Wars reference. And so I was like, sure, why not? That's cool.
That's what won you over. Now, at this time, too, Marty's about to do Methods of Mayhem. Did Tommy Lee ever call you up and say, hey, I need some Bert on the rap rock track?
No, but that would have been fun.
That would have been, that record is sick.
I would have loved to have met Tommy Lee. That's one band I've never met anyone in. Actually, no, I never met anyone Motley Crue.
Not even John 5?
I've never met John 5.
Now, you do tour with Rob Zombie, though, for this record. Of course, it predates John 5, but the Rob Zombie, Monster Magnet, Fear Factory tour, was that?
That was the first tour for Obsolete, I believe. And that was a lot of fun. It started in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I was stoked because, one, you know, I was a fan of White Zombie. Rob Zombie's new record was started blowing up. It was on that tour that he was on the cover of Rolling Stone, I believe. And I was a huge fan of Monster Magnet already. I wore, you know, even before I was in Fear Factory, I was a huge fan of Monster Magnet. So touring with them was just, woo! I get to meet Dave Windorf again. Awesome. But it was cool. And he would play songs just for me, like, oh, play this song. And so I asked him to play a song off of Spine of God that they never would play. And so I'd say, this one goes out to Bert. I'm like, yes. So I would pretty much watch him from the side of stage almost every day.
You do end up on the Soulfly song, Eye for an Eye.
Eye for an eye, for an eye. Yeah, that's all they wanted me to do. I got to do that because was their producer, Ross Robinson.
Right. Now, famously, up until that point, you guys kind of had like a tense relationship with Ross Robinson because of that first record. So how did that come to be where he was like, oh, you know what? Everything actually is cool. Or how did you decide everything was cool, I guess, is a better question.
Well, I did it for Max and Sepultura. I didn't do it for Ross.
That makes sense.
And I'm, you know, honestly, I mean, water under the bridge, but Ross did it dirty on us after that too. So still not pleased with it.
But song is iconic. They still play it every night. Soulfly still plays it every night. I mean, it's probably their most popular.
Oh, it's
song.
Great. Well, it's off their biggest record.
Max said in some interview not long ago that he loves it because it's like one string. It's just like a caveman song. Like you could just not know.
Absolutely. I mean, and he only has four strings on the guitar to begin with.
Right. So since Reese and Greg, you know, essentially produced and mixed the record, the two records before that were with Colin. Is there anything that you feel like Colin brought to those other records that was missing from Obsolete that you've not even necessarily in a good way, but is there something you think Colin would have done differently since that's who you had worked with up until that point?
Well, Colin is a great producer and he gets a great performance. He captures great performances. He's very positive. But his production style was a little too raw, but he gets great performances and that's his specialty. But there was things happened between D-Manufacture and Obsolete, so Colin had nothing to do with us at that point.
Okay. Was there another producer that you had in mind that you wanted to reach out to? Because you really don't work with anybody for a pretty long gap of time, other than, not to say that working with Reese isn't working with anybody, but, you know, an outside influence.
No, I think we knew we were going with Reese and Greg from the very beginning. It wasn't until Digimortal that they were looking. Roadrunner was like looking for other producers to step up the game. We reached out to Rock. What's his name? Bob Rock, one of them.
Wow, that would have been crazy. Bob Rock producing Fear Factory.
Yeah, obviously he turned that down. Fleming Rasmussen was someone I wanted to use. Trevor Horn, I don't think we ever contacted him, but that was a dream producer I wanted to work with. Yeah, it was Reese and Greg from the very beginning for Obsolete. And Reese was pretty much with us, you know, a lot while we were writing. He would get, you know, the really poorly recorded demos, so he understood what was going on. He'd come to the studio from time to time and hear what we're doing and, you know, give suggestions and for arrangements and whatever. So it was Reese and Greg from the very beginning.
Looking back on it now, it's been 25 years. I think it's perfect in every way. You said mean things about the title track that I don't appreciate. Is there anything that you would have done differently on the album, knowing what you know now and with the experience you had since it?
Well, you brought up a good point. I would have led with a different single, but you know, it transpired the way it did and it all worked out anyway. Cars, you know, that record is kind of defined by Cars to a lot of people, and that's great because it's a iconic track that we just made it our own, really. But what would I change? I don't know. It was all, you know, it was the last analog record we did. It's pre-digital. And even the only digital things that was there was like Reese's synths and sounds that he's creating in his little room. It was to the right of the control room. My vocal booth was to the left. And then it was the main room. So Reese had his whole like system set up, you know, racks of just instruments and just racks of keyboards and things that you would plug in. Looked like an operator's old operator station. But it was cool. No, I don't think I would change anything, really.
Well, me neither. So I'm glad that's what you said. It's perfect in every way.
I'm very proud of that album, obviously, for many reasons. It is a literal time capsule of Fear Factory at that moment, from lyrically to production. It's and visuals. It's a great time period. Great time capsule, really.
With how much you wrote for this record, you know, lyric wise, and you're saying that it got edited down. You know, one of my favorite lyrics on this record in Fear Factory and in life is on Resurrection. You say that you had to remove your skin to see belief in their eyes. Hard as hell. Do you have any favorite lines or anything like that that are on this record that really stick out, that when you wrote it, you were like, oh, that's sick?
Timelessness thing is one of my, lyrically, is a beautiful song. It's very personal for me. So I write lyrics very personal, but to transpose them into a third person kind of idea for the concept. And it was about a breakup, really. It was a bad breakup. So it was intense. I was really feeling that one. So after singing that song, it helped me move on. So it was very cathartic. For me, that's probably my favorite song on the record.
You mentioned that Roadrunner had all these expectations and faith in you. And of course, you fulfilled them. You get this gold record, and it's very exciting. Do you think that the gold record changed the band, whether it be the personalities in it or the perception of it from the label going forward, that whether it reflects on Digimortal having even more pressure on it or just pressure internally or anything like that?
All the above. And it definitely, it was a catalyst for the end, honestly. From interrelationships of the band to the relationship with the label, management, everything. The expectations were so high that they were literally trying to change the band into something else to follow a market that, one, I believe that Fear Factory helped create, but it was a market that we didn't have to sound like because we already had our own sound. So when we were doing Digimortal, obviously new metal bands were becoming the thing. So that's what Roadrunner wanted us to sound like.
And you don't think you already sounded like a nu metal band on Obsolete?
I didn't. Well, nu metal didn't exist.
Wait, the term didn't. That's true. But the bands that were a part of that scene did.
No, I didn't think we were that style at all. I think, you know, the songs like Edge Crusher and like Descent had that vibe because we were already I'm a hip hop fan, classic hip hop.
Yeah, I mean, you just told me you got the chorus from Bone Thugs.
Bone Thugs and Harmony. You know, I was a fan. I loved Cypress Hill at that point. I loved, you know, Ice Cube and Public Enemy and obviously Bone Thugs and Harmony. And there's a lot going on in the hip hop world. So, and, bands like, when we toured with the Sick of It All Biohazard, Biohazard was already putting that vibe into their music as well. So we were just like, yeah, it was a little nod to a tip of the hat to a genre that we all appreciate and put it into our music.
What is your favorite thing about Obsolete? What's something that you look back on with most fondness as far as this record goes?
The touring cycle. I mean, recording was fun. I mean, the whole process was a real growing experience. We did a lot of cool stuff. I did a lot of cool stuff, you know, from even while we were in Vancouver, I was having a blast. We were recording, but I was snowboarding almost every morning. The condo we were staying in was literally 20 minutes away from Cypress Bowl, which is the local ski slopes outside of Vancouver. It took me 20 minutes to go up the hill. I was on the ski lift in 30 minutes. So I would go for a couple hours every morning, and then I would walk to the studio because I'd walk over the bridge and walk to the studio. So it was a lot of fun. The whole experience of recording at Mushroom Studios is very classic place. It was a very historical studio. The Armory, which is owned by Bruce Fairburn, great producer, did Rat and Aerosmith and a lot of 80s bands. those were recorded there. So that was a great place. The touring was a lot of fun. We toured with some great bands. But you asked me the question, what was my favorite thing? And there was one moment that really popped into my head first thing. And we were at the height of Fear Factory's at the height of our moment. It was the night we received our gold records. We were headlining the Roseland in New York City. Doesn't exist anymore, but it was in Midtown. Headlining the Roseland held like 3,000 people, and we're going up on stage, right? The intro music's going up on stage. Raymond's on stage. Dino's on stage. I walk on stage and I look at the crowd, and the crowd's just like going insane, right? And it all hit me. It's like this overwhelming moment for me. It's like, holy fuck. I'm in New York City selling out this fucking awesome place, and the crowd's losing it. And it's the intro to Shock. It's coming in. And that moment, I was like so overwhelmed. I had to turn around, face Raymond, and just like get on my knees. Like, I had to like grasp my composure. It's like, I was about to lose it. Like, I was going to like ball. Like, I was about to bawl in happiness. Like, I was crying happiness. Like, holy fuck, it's amazing. So I had to turn around, grab my composure, and just looked around and like shocked. But it was that moment. It all hit me like a ton of bricks.
And that is our show. Thank you so much to Burton for joining us, and thank you for listening. You can check out Burton's cover of Rammstein's classic track, Du Hast, as heard in the movie How High, starring Redman and Method Man. Remember that? Their roommate? He listens to it? That's available now, and he has original music coming soon, so please
keep an eye out for that, as well as his Ascension of the Watchers project, which is available along with everything BCB at www.burtoncbell.com, unless you want to hit him with a MySpace message. Also, by the way, the movie that he was referring to that has the Smasher Devourer character is A Wind of Amnesia, which is available for free on YouTube.com. It's about an hour and a half long, and it's pretty sick. And I mean both nauseating and cool. But in the meantime, my name is Ryan Rainbow, also nauseating and cool. This is Meep Meep, and yes, that's the best that I could come up with. Bye!